Welcome to a special bonus episode of Cartoon Avatars. This is a conversation I had with Nathan over at Every, which if folks don't subscribe, Every is a it's kind of a bundle of subscription writing. Nathan was formerly the VP of product at Substack before that. They write on a bunch of interesting topics related to tech, and he launched a podcast with his co-founder, Dan. And the name of the podcast is Ordinary Astronauts. I was somehow one of their first guests. I don't know how they must have gotten turned down by a lot of people. So this is a conversation that I had with Nathan, in which he kind of interviews me about starting this podcast, about the state of the venture landscape. Really interesting conversation. He was thoughtful in all his questions, and we went in a bunch of different directions. So hopefully you enjoy this this bonus episode here now.
Logan, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Excited to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I want to talk about two things really in this conversation. First being like what's going on with venture capital right now, that a lot of things seem to be changing kind of beneath our feet. And then second, I want to spend a lot of time talking about cartoon avatars and your Twitter and the TikTok and just hear about the sort of content machine that you're creating.
Sure.
But let's start with what's happening like right now. I feel like we're kind of the first quarter of 2022 was like, things kind of keep going down. And then somewhere around the turn of like, you know, March, when we're getting into the second quarter, it's like, oh shit, things are actually pretty bad. And it's only pretty much gotten worse from there in public markets. I don't think it's clear at all that we found any sort of bottom yet in public markets. How is that translating to VC? Because I'm not involved in much, you know, fundraising discussions, or I don't really have a lot of visibility into maybe if a lot of rounds are on pause, or if valuation conversations are running really differently than they did earlier this year. I'm just curious from you, like, what are you seeing?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the way I sort of think about the private markets, so public markets, there's thousands of transactions a day, right, that end up coming up with some price. And it's a ton of people agreeing on what something should be worth, right? Private markets are more akin to like, you know, selling your house. It only happens every so often. And it's hard to know what anything's worth if your neighborhood's changed around you.
Zillow found that out the hard way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But if the neighborhood's changed around you, maybe you did some additions to the house, whatever it is, like you can try to come up with an estimate of what you're worth, but you actually have to go to the market and determine what people are willing to pay for your house. And then all it takes is one, right? And so it's not consensus based in the same way that the public markets are, where it's thousands of people agreeing to it on a second basis. It's a handful of people poking at something. And then it's one person saying, hey, I think it's worth this. And the CEO saying, okay, sounds good. Right.
Yeah.
And then there's this interesting dynamic, especially as you get earlier stage, where ultimately it's actually not that you're selling your house, but it's that you're inviting someone to be your roommate. Right. And so you're actually taking far more into consideration, gosh, well, you know, what's this person's hygiene like? Do I get along with them? All of this stuff that you wouldn't if you were just selling your house. Hey, that guy smells bad, but whatever, I don't really care, right? And so the private market, I guess I say all of that in that each pocket of this is, it's ultimately a derivative of the public markets, right? Because like, for the most part, what we're underwriting to is a public market outcome. And so what I think we've seen is a couple things. One, most of the companies, the A-plus businesses, raised last year more than enough money for them to get through this period of time, right? And so a lot of people are just sitting on their hands saying, hey, you know, not my problem, right? I have more than enough cash. And so a lot of those companies are just have so much cash that they're hanging out on the sidelines. Then there's some businesses that maybe kicked the can and said, hey, you know, well, we'll be a little bigger at this point in time. And it's been good for 12 years in the market, plus or minus. And so why don't we just wait till, you know, July next year to go raise, right? So those people are at the later stages, they're very much in this price discovery mode of like, hey, what do people think we're worth, right? And ultimately, investors at the later stages, like before they go public, they're taking their cues from the public markets. Yeah. But at the end of the day, all it takes is one person to say, hey, I think the multiples are going to go back to being up, or hey, I think this business, their plan, they're going to beat, you know, even what they think. All it takes is one person saying that for the market, quote unquote, to determine that's what the valuation is, quote unquote. And so I think at the growth stage, there's a lot of companies that that when they're raising, they just have to talk to a lot of people, right? It's sort of like this unique house that, you know, it might be perfect for one person out there, but it might be their dream home, but it doesn't appeal to 90% of the population or whatever. You're trying to figure out like what the value is, which I think leads to very long processes. It leads to feeling like you're jerked around. It leads to feeling like there's a bunch of ambiguity and uncertainty in the market. And so I think at the growth stage, like there's that whole thing going on. And I think that that's really hard as an entrepreneur to be out there trying to figure out like, hey, I just want the money. You tell me what it's worth. And it's really hard if like in December, people were telling you, maybe you didn't take the money, but people are telling you, hey, I'm a unicorn, right? Or yeah. You're a unicorn. I'm willing to give you $1 billion. And now those same people are like, you know, we're not investing right now, right? Or we think you're now worth 200 and not a billion. And so I think it's very weird at that point in time. And then the last thing I'll say is at the early stage, I think for the most part, it's still business as usual. Like deals are getting done. Prices maybe have come down a little bit. You know, that's just anecdotal, but I think prices, ultimately all this stuff adjusts down.
Yeah.
But you're not going to be right or wrong about investing in a company if you're swinging big and hoping these businesses are going to be worth billions and billions of dollars, and you're deciding between 40 post and 60 post and 80 post. Like, sure, those are big differences nominally, but like if the investment works, it's ultimately going to be worth a lot. And if it doesn't work, it's not going to be worth a lot. And so the situations that you get caught in the middle and like, hey, 60 post is a good deal, but 40 post isn't, are just so few and far between, right? And so ultimately as an asset class, that matters, but for any individual investment, it doesn't. And so I think early stage is still business as usual.
Yeah. So, but I'm curious about that kind of like, especially the sort of Series A-ish, maybe like a late A, maybe they raised a really big seed round. So the A is kind of coming on the heels of more traction. Are you seeing a company that could fetch 80 post, maybe fall of last year, be closer to 60 or 40 now? Like what? I know it's hard because it, like every house is different. Like you, I think it's a really good analogy, but just roughly, you know, like if you had to give like a zestimate of you know, your average, whatever, quote unquote, which there's no such thing as average in this market, but
this sort of goes to like a fundamental question of what are valuations, right? Yeah. And so this is where the house thing kind of breaks down, because for a house, you're ultimately saying, hey, I'm walking away from this transaction, right? And this is my only bite at the apple. And so I want to maximize the absolute valuation that I'm going to get out of it, because that those dollars, the difference between paying $1 million and $1.2 million is an additional, you know, 20% to me. And I will never look at that house again. I'm moving to the other side of the country, right? The difference in the venture market is all of these things are somewhat, at the early stage especially, it's an arbitrary function of what it takes to get the deal done and what you think ultimately the business can be worth. And so when we're talking about like, let's say, hey, your business plan for every, you're saying, hey, you know, all we need is $10 million, right? And that can get us to profitability. Okay, great. I'm saying, hey, I want to own 25% of your company, and I want to give you $20 million for that, right? And you're saying, well, all I need is 10. And I'm saying, well, I've got this big fund. I want to give you 20. And so ultimately, we agree, and you say it's okay, I'm worth 80 post now, right? $20 million bought me 25% of the company. It's 80 post. Well, someone else could have a smaller fund and say, you know what? All I can give you is 10. But all you want is 10, right? Like that extra $20 million is going to sit on your bank account, on your balance sheet. And there's some cases to be made that having a lower valuation is actually better. It gives you the ability to give options at a lower price to your employees. It sets up success. If you do choose to raise another round, you can raise it, you know, definitely as an up round, right? All of these things, there's some case to be made that that's better, especially if you're never going to touch the extra $10 million, right? And so maybe you pick to go with the person that is giving you 40 posts for 10 million, because that's all you need, right? Well, now the valuation is half. Is it actually half? Not really, right? You just sort of decided that, like, I'm going to give out 25% of the company and I don't need that extra $10 million anyway. And so be it. So a long-winded way of answering a fairly simple question of, like, all of these things of what valuation is somewhat an arbitrary function of, especially at the early stage,
yeah,
picking the partner you want and figuring out how much cash you need and making your existing investors and employees happy. And if you can do all of those things, like if your seed investors are going to have a down round at 40 posts, let's say the round was done at 60 and now it's your seed investors are going to be like, F off. No, we're not doing that, right? Go take the 80 post. If your seed investors got in at, you know, 8, they're going to be like, oh, well, it's your call as the CEO. We would prefer more cash on the balance sheet. This could go on longer than you think, this recession, blah, blah, blah. So a long-winded answer is, it's definitely happening that there's price pressure occurring in all of this stuff. How much and to what extent at the early stage? TBD. I would guess, especially with how much capital is in the ecosystem, I would guess it doesn't end up correcting that much at the early stage. And it does at the late stage, but that's just a theory. I don't have data to actually back that up.
Got it. Because, like, I think it's really smart to understand, like, when valuation decisions are made, especially at the early stage, you know, it's not like someone whose independent job is to come up with the most accurate possible number. If you had to, like, measure a willingness to pay of all the investors and, like, you want to hit somewhere right in, like, where the supply and demand curves, right, you know, intersect or whatever, like, that's not the point. The point is, how much cash do you need? And then what kind of ownership requirements do the VCs have? And how much dilution is the entrepreneur willing to take on?
And who do you want? Right. Who do you want? And that's where you see people get discounts based on their brand, right? Hey, I'll go work with SoftBank at X, but I'll work with Sequoia at Y, right? And there are spreads that exist based on the brand, based on the perception, based on the value add, all that stuff as well.
Totally. Right? Totally. And I guess one of the important inputs to that function is, for a founder, your kind of assessment of the probable outcomes. And everybody wants to say, okay, we're going to be the biggest company ever. But, like, of course, you know, there's a degree of probabilities. And I think that if you look at kind of what's happening to a lot of companies now, where the valuation that they thought they could get is like, well, maybe I'm able to get half that if I'm a really late stage company, right? Or, like, you know, thinking about IPOing, maybe now I'm not thinking about IPOing. For earlier stage companies, it also weighs on you because, you know, acquisition budgets might go down, they might freeze up. There's a lot of risk in that. And the higher your valuation, you're kind of raising the stakes. Like, the level of outcome you can get, of exit that you can get that is considered a win, is, you know, harder and harder to attain the higher your valuation is.
Yeah, that's right. And the easiest way to make 20 million bucks is, like, to own 100% of a company and sell it for 20 million bucks. The hardest way to make 20 million bucks is to own 2% of a company and sell it for $1 billion, right? And it's just like, it's like the absolute gravity of these numbers end up being impactful in terms of there's a lot of people that will buy a company for $20 million. There's not a lot of people that will buy a company for $1 billion, right?
And so exactly.
Ultimately, the gravity of these numbers and what expectation of success you're striving for end up being pretty impactful to how you run the business.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm really curious if it feels like that's changing the calculus for many founders right now, because, you know, Every's pretty much a different kind of business. Like, we're really building it for, like, the very long term. You know, it's not kind of a traditional tech VC type business. But I can imagine, like, if I'm looking out and I'm thinking about my willingness to take on the increased risk of an increased valuation, right? It was probably very different in the fall of 2021 than it is in the summer of 2022. And I'm curious if you see that as a force that's, like, kind of bringing valuations down as well, because obviously investors, they like the valuations to go down to some extent, like, it's because it allows them to buy equity cheaper. But I feel like with entrepreneurs, this is sort of a subtle point that is lost a lot in kind of, like, the conversations on Twitter, is a lot of entrepreneurs might actually like that too, because it's decreased risk in their part.
Yeah. You know, it's a funny, the whole trope about like VCs are willingly suppressing prices to try to get better deals. It's funny. Right. Like,
yeah, it's like, oh, the sky is falling. Yeah.
I'm like, people say that. And from a game theory standpoint, it's like a prisoner's dilemma that immediately falls apart. It's sort of like if you were selling your house and your real estate agent had conspired with every other real estate agent to like, you know, drive down the prices to sell the deal. But like, anytime one real estate agent breaks from that and says like, hey, you know what? I promised this group that I would do this, but I'm going to get you the actually best price and negotiate on that. The whole thing breaks down because now no one trusts anyone else. And like, take that and apply that to like 60 very ego or 100 very egocentric, like money hungry investors and try to think about like what back room we could possibly coordinate like a conspiratorial right. effort to drive down prices. It's really
we would
hard.
Meet up at Bin 16 or whatever it was in the marina. Remember Angel Gate from way back in the day?
Yeah, that's right. It's just like, it's one of those things that I get how it sounds good in theory, but in practice, it's just like, how would that actually ever occur when we're all acting in our own self-interests? But your point is it's a good one where ultimately, there's kind of a trope that VCs cling to, and I fall victim of it, that like discourage people from raising money, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually think, I don't know what percentage it is, if it's 50% or 10% or 75% or 90%, whatever number it is. There's a bunch of companies that I think their ambitions, that are venture-backed, their ambitions should be different. Because of what the ultimate size of the market is, because of their business model, because of the leadership skills of the CEO, because of whatever, a bunch of different things, right? There's only a finite number of markets that I think can and should aspire to be worth, you know, $1, $10, $50, $100 billion. And what's interesting is a lot of people, and it's VC's fault, right? To be clear, because we raise all this money and then we try to convince entrepreneurs that they should go because we have a portfolio of investments, right? Mm-hmm. And so from a construction standpoint, what VCs want is all of their portfolio companies to go as big as they can, right? Because if they turn into a Stripe or a Snowflake, which we were fortunate enough to work with, or turn into a Facebook or a Google or whatever, right? Yeah. That papers over everything else. Well, to an individual entrepreneur, their outcomes can be very meaningful to their life. Like if I have 10 investments and one turns into Google, it actually, everything else is a rounding error, right? All nine of those are a rounding error to me and our fund and our limited partners, right? Well, those are nine other companies, entrepreneurs, employees, like that maybe shouldn't be pushed to go for the absolute biggest outcome, right? Even though that's in my interest. And so at times, that's where the interests of companies and VCs diverge is like, sometimes the answer might be to aim a little lower and to say, hey, you know what, let's keep this price down or let's not go raise that incremental round of funding because then we're going to have investors that want us to go even bigger than what's actually natural for our market or our opportunity. And so I think when you have a million investors in your ear saying, no, you can be $10 billion because almost everything was like somehow worth $1 billion to $10 billion over the last 2 years somehow. Right. And if you can't find a single investor that's like, no, you know what, don't go raise that money. Or yeah, we're fine if you just hit a double on our capital or whatever. Yeah. If you can't find a single investor, like it definitely deludes your thinking. And it's like, wait, if you had thought, hey, maybe my business should only be worth $100 million and that would be an amazing outcome for me and all my employees, but every other investor is telling you, you should go to be worth $10 billion, like it's going to be hard to turn all that down because it seems like free capital. Hey, well, this person's willing to give me a $500 million valuation. Why should I ever settle for a $100 million acquisition, right? But when the incentives diverge, that's where it starts to break down. And so I'm seeing more and more of that. Ultimately, I think it comes down to if a founder, you sort of need to make a decision as a founder of, you can pick maybe two of these, but you can't pick all three. Like, do you want to be rich? Do you want to be king? Or do you want to leave a legacy? Mm-hmm. And like, you're kind of faced with a conundrum. And to be clear, I think the best case scenario, unless you really want to try to be Google and Larry, Sergey, Elon Musk, whatever, like if you just want to make money, the best case scenario in my mind is like own as much of your company as you possibly can and just methodically build it, right? I think that's like the safest probability weighted thing. When you start wanting to be king, you care about like, you know, how many people you have, you care about, you know, the ability to look good in press releases and have valuations and have all this stuff, right? And that's like a slightly different mindset. And if you want to leave a legacy, you're really focused on like the endurance of the ultimate business and making sure it's built to last. And maybe you actually don't even need to be the CEO. If there's a better person to come in to run the business, like you step aside, like Ryan Peterson did recently at Flexport. And, you know, you want to build something that lasts and the answer might be you, it might not. And so those are kind of the decision trees that I think founders ultimately face. And I think now people are starting to recognize that like it seemed over the last 2 years that you could do all three because VCs were telling you that. And now I think there's more and more people being methodical about like, hey, you know what? I actually think the best outcome for this is not to try to build this long lasting, you know, 100-year legacy where I get to rule over, you know, the GDP the size of a small country and the same number of employees. Instead, like, I'll build a very solid company that's worth $50 million and, you know, sell it and have a very happy life. And so I think that's happening more as people see that there are trade-offs in all these considerations.
Yeah, totally. I think it's a fascinating point and an important one. And to me also kind of an illustration of the idea that the medium is the message. And so in this case, the medium is basically finance, right? And there's this subset of finance that's like high risk finance. That's like, let's see if we can find vehicles that provide risky, but really high returns. And then, you know, what you get from that is the whole idea of startups of, you know, being the next Google, of being the next Facebook. And you get these myths and you get people to kind of promulgate the myths. And then you get a whole bunch of people to try and do the next thing. And you get the people who want to fund them. And it creates, it's like amazing how if you sort of trace back a lot of behavior that we observe around us, it kind of comes back to some like math variables in a spreadsheet that tend to work pretty well for like giant pools of capital getting a little bit more giant using one particular method. You know, that's like a small portion of their actual overall allocation. And it's crazy how it's like, you know, people's lives are like just like shaped by the machinations of these like kind of like universal constants of like risk and reward or whatever. And this is just like one version of it. But a framing thing about the point of, you know, whether a company is should aim higher or lower, basically, and whether you should try and own more or own less, but be bigger. I think the important thing that was missing from what I heard you say in some of it was the aspect of time. Because I think if you just say, do you want to be big or small? It's kind of like, well, yeah, I want to be big, you know? But if you say, okay, and how long are you willing to work on it? And how much control do you want to have? So I think of it less like have a legacy, be rich, or be king, although maybe this ultimately maps back onto it. I think about it like, how much time are you willing to commit? How big do you want it to be? And what do you want it to ultimately be, kind of, which is like size is one aspect of it. And like, how much control do you want to have? So big, I guess, is rich. Control is king. And then time, I guess, is legacy. But I think of it more like a cost. Like, I'm willing to incur the cost of time on every in order to have it be really big and to have a lot of control over it. That's like Dan and I, you know, Dan, my co-founder, we've been really clear on like, we want this to be really big. Like, we don't view it as a small potential thing. We think building a really great audience and learning a lot and working with a lot of writers and building a subscription business is potentially a vehicle longer run into like other businesses. I think Silicon Valley is very like, you know, monomaniacally focused on like the single product company, but a lot of great companies in history were built as kind of like slow roll empires where you parlay one thing into another. You know, I mean, look at like Warren Buffett or whatever.
How much of the time component is the depth of time and the effort required versus the length of time and how far in the future you're thinking?
I mean, it's both, like, yeah. But I think it's more about the length of time. So like, I work pretty hard now. Like, I don't know. I hate the whole like debate over like, how hard should you work or whatever? Like, I don't know. I feel like I work basically as hard as I can without sacrificing the really important things in my life, like family or my health or whatever. And I kind of have a sense of where my own limit is. And it's the kind of thing like, you know, if you're an athlete, you know, where your physical limits are. And it's important to push it to that point, but not too far beyond for too long. Otherwise you ruin kind of everything. So that's basically how I think about how I operate.
Yeah. What's interesting, I guess, and maybe this is a function of investing mostly at Series B, C stage, is that like the opportunity cost of time, I think, feels a lot more material, I would say, in the very early days of company. You know, when you're in the in my world, the seed or, you know, pre-seed or angel or series, you know, the second seed or whatever people call it, like
yeah,
when you're still seed. In the early days, your obligation to the money you've taken on, the people you've hired, the product you've built, all of that is you still can think about like, okay, what if I go back and work at Google, right? Mm-hmm. Or what if I go work at like this other company that has more certainty and I wouldn't have to sacrifice all the depth of the time and more certainty on like the length, and maybe I'll have another great idea in the future. And that's one of the things, like sometimes when big company execs leave and say they're going to go start a company, like it's interesting because generally they've made more than enough money. And generally their time can be assessed in a very quantifiable way to what they walked away from and what they could walk back into, right? And yeah. So that's an interesting thing versus a lot of the CEOs I back. One, it's the decision's already been made at Series B, C. Like the door is not really going back the other way. There's not like an opportunity cost at this point. The toothpaste is out of the tube. And so you've sort of set the train in motion. And it's sort of like, yes, you're making a decision of how big and how long you want to sign up for the ultimate exit. But for the most part, you're going for it in some meaningful way, right? And that's one of the conversations I have with CEOs is like, you know, how long we're going to do this as long as it takes to build this into the company it should be, right? And if they don't want to do that, then I'm not the right investor for them. And so yeah. I guess it's a function of maybe the types of companies that I talk to and assessing that the ambitions, ultimately what I said about like, I want the people, and this is why I'm very comfortable with secondary for founders, is because I want their incentives to be aligned with mine and going as big as they possibly can.
Yeah.
And if, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, whatever it is, changes their willingness to pursue the ambitions that align with me, then I'm very comfortable with that. And so I guess maybe it's, I live in this little bubble of like, I mean, I definitely do, but the like worldview I have is informed by the types of founders I work with.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's interesting because I feel like there's even different orders of magnitude time commitments than that. Like there's the, I'm going to try this for a couple of years. And if it doesn't seem to be taking off, I'm not really down to struggle. And I want to go back to get, you know, like a 400K salary somewhere type level of commitment. There's the, I want to see this business through to a really great exit, you know, be the CEO for maybe a little while after that. And then like, you know, if it's an IPO, maybe eventually I'll hire a successor, or if I get acquired, I'll stay there for a while to kind of like vest in peace and then think about my next company. I think that's the more typical kind of like 10-ish year time horizon. Dan and I mean, literally one of the biggest risks that we focus on is, are we having fun and how's our relationship? Because the goal is that this is the last company that we work on. And we might fail. I mean, odds are we'll fail, right? Though there might be other things we do. But I just think it would be absolutely sick to enjoy the benefits of compounding for decades on a thing. Like it feels like it's very rare for people to think that way, because it feels, I don't know, it's like, I don't know, it's weird. It's like getting married or something like that, you know? Like it's too, yeah, it's a little bit too much. Like even for the sort of like long-term, you know, like typical VC-backed company, which to me feels, it's almost like a financial vehicle more than an institution that someone wants to build as like a life's work type thing. And I think when you shift the perspective to like the life's work institution building type thing, certain things become really important to optimize for that maybe aren't that important if you're building a financial vehicle that's got like a 10, 15 year time horizon. And again, like I think our thing can be really big, but we're sacrificing some growth for sure for the next like couple years because we're prioritizing certain like, you know, ownership things or whatever other things we think we need.
Yeah. Just like the natural pace of absorption, you're sort of balancing the absorption in the market with the ownership you want to have, with how big you want the company to be versus like all those things. There's all these things are trade-offs. I think it's interesting. You know, I've been a career investor. And so a lot of my, I get the breadth of experience and domain across a bunch of different industries, a bunch of different types of people, a bunch of different end markets, a bunch of different scenarios. But two things. One, because of the stage I'm investing, I only really see like plus or minus two types of companies. There's kind of like the cash efficient business that's like, you know, raise some money, but now trying to be more ambitious than they've been. And then there's like the venture backed company that's now, you know, raising their subsequent round. And for the most part, there's a lot of decisions that have been made along that journey that don't, that I'm not privy to, but I get a lot of like those types of things. I could talk forever, you know. And so your experience, it's funny, like, and what your considerations and trade-offs are. I ultimately don't really have that much of a perspective about all these things. Like I get it conceptually, but I haven't lived any of the things you're talking about, with the exception, and maybe this is an interesting segue, you know, the podcast that I started, it's a funny thing where I'm not really sure to what end I'm doing it, other than like the thesis behind it was, we started it in the beginning of February with two buddies. And, My thought was, I watched the success of All In, right? Mm-hmm. And
this is the podcast with Jason Calacanis and
Chamath, David Sachs, and David Freeberg. Yep,
right.
So four people that self-proclaimed billionaires that have been investors and founders and an interesting group of buddies started a podcast and during the pandemic, and now it's like a top, I don't know, 25 podcast in the world, something like that.
Really, they had like a big conference thing recently.
Yeah, they did a conference, but it's been amazing. And one of the things that kind of hit me was that the market, in the same way that Hollywood was started to be covered in the 50s, and then politics and sports started to get covered in the 80s and 90s, where people were intrigued by like the different dynamics and the inside baseball of stuff and the different personalities and all that stuff. It became clear to me over the course of the pandemic, partially because of this podcast All In that they started, partially because of Elon Musk, partially because of Robinhood and meme stocks, partially because of crypto, that we were entering this world of like this intrigue about tech and investing and venture. And like, it was starting to be covered in a really interesting way. And there was clearly this appetite for people to get a peek behind the curtains of like what's going on, right? And so I was watching all this happen, and the market over the last 2 years has just been insanely competitive. And you know, you have former CEOs, you have CROs of companies, you have CTOs of companies, you have Tiger Global with infinite amounts of money. You have all these people investing now into private companies, right? And I'm like a 34-year-old career finance person that like started tweeting at the beginning of the pandemic and kept tweeting and like ended up having a decent audience. But I'm like, gosh, how do I stand out in this world? And my Twitter is very, I sort of had one voice, which was kind of Stephen Colbert for the Colbert Report of tech, where I'm just like always in character, only a personality, like poking at stuff in a ironic way and saying it like I didn't understand what was going on, but was kind of the joke guy, right?
Yeah.
And whenever I would deviate from that, people were like, hey, go back to being the joke guy, right? And I was like, all right, well, this is kind of becoming my thing. And so I looked at all this and I was like, hey, maybe there's an opportunity for someone that's, you know, young. I'm about as young as, you know, there's probably people a couple of years younger, but like to be on the inside, general partner, managing director, whatever. And you can't be that much younger than me and be at a firm that's like, you know, been around for 20 plus years or whatever. Like one of those, like you can be a little bit younger, but not that much younger. Right. And so I felt like I was both very much on the inside I came from the outside. Like, I went to a small school in Virginia. I didn't know anyone in tech. I sort of fell into all this stuff. And so I still sort of have this outsider-ish view about everything that's going on. I don't feel like I'm on the inside, even though I definitely am. And it felt like I could have a unique voice to weigh in on all this stuff. And I thought, hey, it might be a differentiator for just my awareness and people knowing who I am. And so we started doing it. And I guess to bring it back to what we were talking about, like, I actually can't relate at all for the types of companies I invest in to the experience of Every, right? Mm-hmm. But I can in some ways to the podcast I started, because now it's had success and I'm having fun, but I don't know to what end. I'm not totally sure what I don't want to do a conference. We haven't taken, I get pitched all the time for advertising and I don't want to do that. I'm sort of funding it out of pocket with Redpoint right now. And my partners have been gracious in doing that. And so I don't really know, do I want to be as big as I possibly can be? Is that like a good thing to get stopped on the streets? I don't think so, right? Yeah. I don't know if that's even within reach of what I'm doing. And so it's funny, like, this has now had success and it's starting to escape from my little orbit of, like, you know, listenership and all that. And I don't exactly know to what end, right? I'm kind of like, it's possible I just shut it down, you know, like, I don't know. So I'm having fun with it, but that's kind of the quick backstory. You had asked about it earlier. And I think it does to, like, what you're thinking about to some extent.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think there might be something unique about media, or maybe a fancier word that doesn't really describe what I do, but, you know, would be like art, right? Like, people creating something personal and creative, you know, even if it's funny or sarcastic or whatever, like, it's personal. And the way that you relate to that type of creation is just really different from kind of like a normal transactional-ish type thing. And yeah, maybe there is something. I hadn't honestly really related, like, why it feels really natural or like obvious for Dan and I to try and think of Every as like potentially the last company that we ever work for. But probably, yeah, a big part of it is because it's like, I don't know, we're like writing essays where it's like, we're trying to create, and it also seems like media companies, the really good ones, do have that kind of longevity, like the New Yorker, the New York Times, the Atlantic, like, you know, it seems like there's something about the natural, we're like it's like a turtle or something. It's not like the biggest animal, but it lives like a really long time or something. Like, that's like how these kinds of media companies are. So yeah, I hadn't really related to that before, but
it's 100% interesting in terms of all of that stuff, right? And I think I don't know how you think about it. Like, I assume to some extent, because it's your business, right, you look at the metrics as somewhat of an assessment. You could write the best piece and maybe you get internal gratification for having done it, right? But like, at the end of the day, if the numbers don't show on it, then, you know, you're probably just like, oh gosh, I kind of missed on it. Or definitely, because you're solving for your business, right? And what's interesting for me is all I know is to do that, is to keep growing and keep assessing the metrics and all that. But like, actually, there's some TAM that I have of like what I'm doing before I start deviating for what I enjoy to get those next rungs. And I sort of saw this with Twitter, where I was like, okay, I found this voice and I figured out how to do it. And at the end of the day, to continue to do it, I couldn't be three-dimensional. I had to be one-dimensional because people come to you for something, right? And so even if I wrote a really thoughtful, interesting thing, if it wasn't ironic or sarcastic or funny, people would be like, what? This isn't what I signed up for, right? I always joke, make me a bicycle clown and Wedding Crashers, like that element of it, right? And so now I'm sort of at this point with the podcast where I actually don't need the money, right? Venture is a great business, which I'm happy to talk about. And this is kind of like a side thing for me that I'm having fun with. And so we haven't taken on advertisers and we're not going to, I don't know, do a conference or anything like that, as far as I can tell. But am I actually satisfied if it's not growing, right? By what metric? Is it just the text that I get that people said, hey, this is a great episode this week from people I respect? Am I willing to do that? Or do I at the end of the day, is the scoreboard the metrics and the growth? And I want to continue to grow. And I don't know the answer to that, right? You have a little bit of a conundrum of the, this is your business, right? This is just sort of my hobby on the side. And so I can be a little bit more pure theoretically about it, right? And not needing the dollars. But at the end of the day, I'm a competitive person. And the only way to know if it's resonating is the numbers going up and to the right. And so I'm addicted to that now increasingly.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's funny because I feel like, you know, there's some people who have the attitude that's like, oh, you know, there's a ton of really beautiful, amazing, wonderful stuff that's just not appreciated. And in my experience, the posts that get a lot of traction really were just better. And the posts that were duds, even if I poured my heart and soul into them later, I can kind of see why that was a dud. And like, it's okay. I was maybe reaching for something that was really interesting, but didn't quite get there. I'm very much, you know, it causes definitely some pain and suffering, but I'm very much like, I generally think numbers are a pretty good indicator of quality. And I mean, we see it over and over again with stuff like that theoretically shouldn't succeed, but does, like Ted Lasso. Who would have thought Americans would watch a sitcom about soccer? You know, but we will if there's something at the core of it that's like really fresh and emotionally true. Or like, you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once, like no one can explain what that movie is, but they're just like, oh my God, like you have to watch it. And I haven't even seen it yet, but everyone keeps saying it. So I'm like, are you sure it's going to be good? And no one will can tell me what it's about. So I'm just like, I don't know. There's probably something good there. But I feel like generally things that are really good, like do numbers.
I think that's right. And ultimately we're not, I mean, you know, people ask, if you go back and look at like the books that we consider, the art that we consider, or the music we consider, you know, from a generational standpoint that have stood the test of time from the 1800s or 1500s, or like, were they appreciated at the time? And like, for the most part, they weren't, right? Like some were, there's obviously exceptions, but for the most part, they weren't. That said, there was much more constraints around distribution that existed in those days. And so like, you know, maybe they would, if they could have tweeted it out, right? Like it very well could have been appreciated in its time, but there were like constraints around who got their eyes on it, where it was, all that stuff. And increasingly now we live in this world where, you know, we're not beholden to our ability to get on a cable news network or our ability to get a book bound in the 1600s or whatever, right? We're not constrained by that. And so we have this near infinite distribution that is the internet. And so for the most part, like, sure, you see some of the downsides of social media. And if we were trying to acquire all our customers through Twitter viral posts or whatever it is, or Facebook's algorithm or something, we would definitely gravitate to more extremes of stuff. But I think you and I both are sort of operating within a certain level of sophistication and, you know, intellect, hopefully, that the rage bait headline type stuff can feel fleeting and also just isn't going to persist for what we're solving for ultimately, because everything else is a click away, right? We have no way of keeping people captive. You know, even if someone's paying you, they could walk away tomorrow. And so it's not like we're trying to keep ratings up to some extent. We're trying to consistently deliver a product to the people that come and hopefully the people that will come, right?
Yeah, totally. And maybe it's sort of the most useful mindset about this stuff depends on what kind of problems a person is most likely to run into. And like for me, I think I have very little risk of doing something that I'm just not going to be proud of in the future, or from like an ethical standpoint, or like the few times that I've kind of flirted with being a little bit like disingenuous or clickbaity or whatever, I've always pretty much instantly regretted it. And so like, I feel like, and even those weren't particularly bad examples, it was just me being kind of dumb, like why I thought Quibi was a good idea or whatever, which at the core, I think there was something interesting to say there about like, well, hold on, everyone is shitting on Quibi. Maybe we could make a bull case, you know, which I think I can stand by that impulse, you know, to try and be a little contrarian about that. So maybe for me, it's useful to be like, look, you just got to look at the numbers, because you're prone to do like some whatever thing that you think is deep and thoughtful, but is actually just boring, right?
You know, the irony of advocating for Quibi in this context is like all the reasons Quibi failed is because of all the stuff we're talking about. It's like because of the infiniteness of content and the scalability of all these things, like there are things that can go viral and you don't need to have the high production value of the bottleneck of supply that they did, right? Quibi's ultimate competitor was TikTok and YouTube and Netflix and, you know, everything else, right? Yeah. And so it's funny, like the reason it didn't succeed is sort of what we're talking about, is because of the supply side of all this stuff, right?
Totally.
Which is interesting. It's just like an interesting, Quibi would have been an amazing idea in like 2000, whatever, right when the iPhone came out, or maybe before that, where, yeah, you know, it was kind of the short form bundled mobile, blah, 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 all of that stuff. But now you're competing with people's willingness to watch shitty TikTok videos or shitty production TikTok videos. And so you're competing with the infinite consciousness of the world.
Totally. I think that's right. Quibi would have killed it on the BlackBerry, I think.
Yeah, totally. I actually think so, right? In a world of constraints, but now in a world of abundance of content, like, you know, it doesn't work, right?
Totally. I think it's interesting because the number one thing I took away from it is they used a storytelling toolkit that only works if you have like at least 30 minutes and probably more likely an hour or longer of somebody's attention and time, which is great for if it's on a big screen and you're sitting in a comfortable seat, but they're competing for a form factor and a time commitment that those storytelling techniques just don't work. Like all the things about like setting up a scene and doing a little characterization and doing some foreshadowing, none of that works when you've got like 3 minutes on your phone and you want to like quickly swipe through like 10 different things and like to find something funny or shocking or whatever. Like it's a totally different, like almost job to be done. And so it's like, you know, the things that make a skateboard good, like are totally different from a car, and they thought they were in the same product category. So they brought like car mechanics and, you know, whatever, like design principles and mechanisms to like the skateboard market and failed for obvious reasons.
Yeah. You know, what's funny about that? Like ultimately there's a bunch of like kind of cringy quotes from Netflix over the years about like, we're competing with sleep. That's our main competition. Or, oh, we're competing with like Fortnite, I think it was, like, that's our competition. Yeah. And being very dismissive of like all the other platforms that were coming out. But to some extent, like, I think Quibi thought of themselves as competing with like cable television or just Netflix, right? And yeah, like, hey, we can have a different, more mobile centric Netflix. But at the end of the day, their competition was actually reading in every article in your email inbox, listening to my podcast. It was watching the next TikTok. It was going on YouTube. And so I feel like it's really hard to be prescriptive when these things require very high upfront costs, the way that Quibi's content did. And then to nail what's going to resonate with people, that's really hard to do. And then also when you're competing on a phone with everything else in the world, right? Like they thought, hey, we're competing with Netflix and that's the other app we're competing with. But in truth, they were competing with every other thing you could be doing with your time on the phone, right? And so it's funny, like the hubris of the Netflix guys kind of saying, hey, we're dismissive of the other competitors. I actually think that that's kind of true in a lot of ways, that like your competitors, when you get to a certain scale, ultimately are different than my podcast competes with someone else going to watch Netflix, right? Just because maybe they want to watch whatever other thing out there. And it's not just All In. It's not just, you know, whatever, Lex Friedman. And it's not just these handful of podcasts that like touch on similar themes. It's actually everything else you could be doing. And I think Quibi didn't totally appreciate that.
So I feel like, speaking of being competitive in the arena of content, you have done a great job of that. I feel like there's no podcast in the past couple of years that has sort of captured tech Twitter or VC Twitter in the same way that Cartoon Avatars has. And I'm curious, like, looking back, like, what are the things that you think mattered most? Because so many people want to launch a podcast and usually they don't. And then when they do, it usually doesn't go that well. And so, you know, just asking for a friend, not myself personally or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
What you've learned, like what ended up being important?
I set different milestones for myself when we started of, hey, in 4 weeks, let's check in. In 3 months, let's check in. In 6 months, let's check in. And in 1 year, let's check in. And at each point along the way, I gave myself the off ramp to like shut it down. And so I was just trying to get to the next rung. Am still trying to get to the next rung, right? We'll hit the 6 month mark here in, I don't know, another 4 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever it is. And like, I feel pretty good about where we're going, but like, I'm not 100% figured out exactly what it is. And so each point in time, I think if you're just staring out in the abyss of like, gosh, this isn't growing to the extent that I was hoping it would, or is this product resonating or whatever, to some extent, just like setting these different milestones in front of me and being like, I'm just going to keep going to that additional bogey in the future, and then I'll take inventory, just psychologically allowed me to keep going. There's some crazy stat I'm sure you can look up, but like, you know, 90% of podcasts don't make it past their fourth episode. And then yeah, the next like 9% don't make it past their like 12th or something. Like there's some stat like that, that like to some extent to persist is to succeed. Right. And so I think that was one, is just being realistic about expectations. The other two things, I think the insight of, hey, someone that's on the inside that still views themselves in a lot of ways as on the outside, that is old enough to be of a certain level or seniority, but young enough to still talk a different, talk in a more accessible way. I think there was something to that insight that I was like right place, right time, in that tech was now being viewed as this like palace intrigue type situation. And so I think that was lucky. I don't know if I totally appreciated that. Some of it I did, some of it I didn't, but I think that was fortunate. I guess two other things. One was, I fortunately had because I had a decent Twitter presence already, it gave me a credibility and access to a bunch of people that I only knew of, right? And so like Parker Conrad, the founder of Zenefits and then Rippling, came on and gave like his side of the story of the Zenefits leaving and everything with Andreessen Horowitz and everything with David Sachs, who was like his COO. And he had never really told the story. And and he did, and he told it to me. And now we can assess why. And I think it's because I got him at the right time. Now he's been successful in his own new company. And so it's not sour grapes. And we did it in person. And I was able to make it like a comfortable sort of free flowing conversation and whatever. We can analyze all that. But like literally how I got to Parker was he followed me on Twitter and I DM'd him. And he was positively inclined to me because of my Twitter. And so I think that was kind of like a fortunate thing as well. And then I think what's also kind of occurred is we've reached this volatility point in the market where there's just like a lot of interesting stuff going on. And, you know, when it's all bubblegum and apple motherhood and apple pie or whatever, you know, it's not as interesting. But now when companies are going under or you know, whatever.
Right. Volatility leads to uncertainty, which leads to demand for people to explain what's going on.
So I think what's fortunate in that is now with Zach Weinberg involved, I'm kind of like a neutral-ish voice. Like I have opinions about stuff, but like I only hold a few opinions very near and dear. And even then I'm willing to have like an amicable conversation where I would love to walk away from the conversation with a good relationship to whoever I talk to.
Yeah.
And so I think that leads to like,
very Southern of you, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. It sort of goes back to my Southern roots. And so I don't know if I independently, with all this volatility and stuff going on, if I independently would be interesting enough to host a podcast. I think I would be beholden to getting other interesting people involved. But I think Zach coming on and being something of a, he's sort of like the perfect, he's post cancellation because he's made a ton of money. He's has the credibility of selling to companies, right? He's brilliant. And actually I've never met someone that cares less what people think other than being right. And so like all those things are kind of the perfect foil to me, and also the perfect like entertainment for a content standpoint. And so I think that was lucky. And he wouldn't commit to doing it full time for a while. I just kept pulling him in and kept like letting him take it in the direction he wanted to go. And now he's just really having a good time with it. And so now he's going to come on and do it more. And so I think it was just like a bunch of these things together. But yeah, it's been lucky. Some of this was intentional. Some of this was just like hard, you know, willingness to keep my head down and keep going. And some of this was just like fortunate circumstances of the time or the people that I had access to.
Totally. I'm curious because like the original incarnation of the show was three cartoon avatars, yeah, and you had Zach and Nikita. So you've actually had two Zachs.
That's right.
As co-hosts so far in 2022. And like I think a lot of people had their original concept for the show. It seems like basically like, you know, Nikita's building a company and Zach, with his the way that his job works, it was hard for him to be opinionated or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically the TLDR. Nikita, you know, he said it was taking up too much time and he wanted to go back to working on his company. And he was always like frazzled when we were like, he was coming off of a bunch of, I don't know, investor pitches or whatever it was. Like right, yeah, he had a bunch of people living in his house and it always seemed.
He had a bunch of people living in his house?
Yeah. He had like a bunch of engineers living in his house with him starting this company. And he was always like kind of frazzled coming into it. And I ultimately think like he just didn't enjoy it that much. Like people can be fucking mean and you just get random mean comments. And it's like, you sort of need to appreciate the good way more than the bad to keep slogging. And he's like, I have all this stuff going on and I get random strays from people like, you know, talking shit and I don't need this in my life. I think that was, he's never actually said that to me, but I think that was kind of his calculus. Yeah. Zach, General Catalyst is an RIA and their compliance team had to review every transcript, which was at different points in time was fine. And in others, it was somewhat less fine. And and so he actually volunteered by the end as we were sort of going back and forth. And honestly, I'm surprised they even let him do it. I think they were amazing to him, to us, in terms of like their willingness to try to make it work. But but at the end of the day, when compliance department needs to read everything before we push it live and like maybe make comments on stuff, it just really comes at a trade-off of timeliness and like content. And, you know, and so ultimately we're still good friends. And he, I think it ended very amicably, but yeah, I was kind of on my own for a little while there.
Yeah. So like, what was that like? Like, so, you know, the kind of original three cartoon avatars team has sort of like fallen apart. The show name changes to Cartoon Avatars and it's just your sad little one head in the corner as compared to the three heads you used to have on the cover art. Like,
I keep offering to Zach, by the way, to Zach Weinberg to go on the cover art. And he's like, no, I don't want that. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to. And it's funny, like All In almost blew up over like ownership and ego and all whatever, like how much people, different people got the other podcast that I was kind of thinking of when we started. And like, I can't even get my co-host to like willingly put his face on the thing. That's how like little ego we have right now. I'm just like, dude, come on, like just we'll put our heads on. He's like, I don't want that right now. Like, let's let it go. Right.
Amazing. Yeah. But I'm curious, like, did you consider like trying something else or shutting it down or like what, and how did you think through like what to do next?
The most uncertain part of it all was like, I knew I could do interviews in an interesting way and like pull interesting stuff out of people. Like I knew I could do that. Right. And so there were kind of two models I looked at where I don't know, to the extent people listen to sports podcasts, but like part of my take is a podcast I listen to a lot. And it's interesting personalities talking about sports in a slightly irreverent way. And then they interview someone and then they go back to doing sort of topical stuff. And so my thesis was, people come for whoever you're interviewing, but stay for the relationship that they develop with you and the other people. And so not everyone needs to be like a superstar, right? Not everyone needs Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant on the team. You can introduce, Howard Stern was kind of the original one that did this. You can introduce like just the audio engineer or the producer, or like they don't all need to be like, you know, $1 billion company CEOs or whatever. Like,
so that means I might have a chance to make it on.
Yeah, exactly. You could do it.
Great.
But my concern was that I inherently wasn't interesting enough to carry the topical elements of the show, that I didn't have like hard enough opinions, interesting enough insights. Like that was the most ambiguous part of it. And so I was trying to figure out like, who can I get on that I had chemistry with, that wanted to do it, that was willing to, you know, be interesting and have interesting opinions and all that. And I made a short list and Weinberg was actually top of my list. I'm trying to think of who else. Aaron Levy, I wanted to get. There were like a couple people. I can't think of who else was on my list.
Chris Dixon.
Yeah, Chris Dixon. Yeah, exactly. He stopped responding to anything I said long, long ago. But and so having Zach come in was a godsend for that, because ultimately I think the recurring nature of it and the trust that you build with the audience is their relationship to you and what you can get out of people and not beholden to any one individual guest. And so I knew that I could shoot my shot with like a handful of guests that I could keep it going for some period of time, right? And I ultimately got Levy to come on, and I got Parker to come on, and I got, you know, a handful of Alexis Gay to come, and I got a handful of like interesting people that I liked a lot to come on. And that was kind of like a bridge period in time where I was most uncertain that I was going to be, it was maybe going to evolve just to an interview show. And now it's sort of taken another format because Weinberg's really good at this other thing. But there was definitely a period in time in which I wasn't totally sure we were going to make, I mean, I guess I'm still not sure we're going to make it, but I was just like head down every week, just like press publish. And that was another thing I guess I didn't mention up front was just like the routine of like, hey, it doesn't matter where I am, what's going on in the world, what's going on in my life, who I have as a guest, we're recording and there's an episode going live, right? Yeah. And that was really needed for like 3 or 4 weeks of like anxiety around just getting it out there. And so now that's less of a problem. But yeah, it was definitely a little uncertain for a little while there.
Amazing. Well, it's brand new, but it's super exciting. And it's cool to see how it launched. It got a little spark of the first thing, co-host situation didn't work out. And then the second sort of like act already, I guess, has been, I'm curious, like, I don't know, can you give us like any rough, like downloady type numbers?
Yeah. So we've been growing. It's hard. Maybe you'll find this. It's actually really hard to track listenership across all these different mediums, right? Yeah. Because we upload, and this is a little inside baseball, but we upload through one platform to be able to publish video to Spotify, then YouTube's another platform. Yeah. Then, you know, Apple Podcasts is a third, but some do it on plays, some do it on views, some do it it's on downloads. So it's like a total mess, right? And so I don't even want to, I haven't checked this past week because I kind of just don't want to know. I wasn't like thrilled with the ultimate end product. I don't know where we're going to run this. So maybe we'll run this in an ambiguous time that people don't know what episode I'm talking about.
Sure. We'll make it ambiguous, but the guest was very pleased with his resume.
Yeah, exactly. So I wasn't like thrilled with the output of the whole thing. So I haven't actually checked the numbers because I don't really want to know. But we've grown since it really took off. It was like 20% a week, 20% a week, like 15% a week, and then like 12% a week. And so ultimately we're getting to some gravitational numbers that you know, obviously the growth rate slows down. But my ambitions, I think, to be like a consistent top 5 tech podcast, you kind of need to get to like 100,000 downloads to be in that range. And if you look at that, it's always pretty consistent. It's like Lex Friedman, All In, something called like Darknet Diaries or something. There's like a few tech podcasts that are like consistently at the top of the charts. And so my ambition is to consistently land in top 5. We've bumped around, you know, at our highest 7 or 8. We dropped down to like 13, 14, 15, 16. We've fallen off for a couple of weeks in there. We were like out of the top 100. Again, back to, I don't know if that's the right metric to orient around, but that's sort of like my own goals for it, is to keep the growth up, keep growing every week, make a good product I'm proud of, and hopefully land as a consistently top 5 thing. So
amazing. Well, I'm rooting for you. And, you know, if you ever need like an extremely charming and famous guest,
Exactly.
Well, once you start to get really low on your list,
it's funny. We're starting to get the inbound of folks volunteering come on, which is nice. It's one of these self-referential things that like I can say, oh well, Aaron Levy's come on, and Keith Raboy and Parker Conrad, and I can't even remember who all the guests I've had. Eric Kleiman from Ramp, and we have like a bunch of other interesting people scheduled. And so now I can kind of point to everyone else and be like, no, it's legit, right? But before, it's like you just got to keep faking it. And so now I'm getting proactive outreach to people and a much more willingness to come on. But you know, the early days was kind of just leading on friends and friends of friends. So
Yeah, totally. Totally. No, it's amazing. Cool. Well, I'm excited. Maybe I can have you back, depending on whether this podcast crashes and burns or not. Maybe I can have you back in a couple of years. And well, you've been number one. You've vanquished David Sacks in more ways than one, because you vanquished him kind of on the Parker Conrad episode.
Listen, I did nothing. I did. Kraft is a friend of our firm, and Parker had a story to tell, and I was just his. I was just the person he told it to. But I, yeah,
fair, no, that is true. But we'll say you vanquished his podcast with the All In thing. You'll be number one. That's what we're rooting for.
Hopefully, my ambitions are to get ahead of them one day. But and I've jokingly kind of trolled. They've been very gracious to me, but yeah. I've jokingly definitely trolled them as like kind of stoking a competition between the two. But yeah, my advice for this in general is just keep at it. I mean, you get it from writing, right? It's like you know, this is just a. It's just a game of like getting some of these things out there in the wild and tweaking and improving and all that stuff and sort of setting realistic milestones. And so, yeah, I'm glad you're doing this. It's funny, people get mad about like, I got a lot of backlash when we launched, like who needs other tech bros having a podcast, right? Yeah. And I'm like, these are infinitely scalable. Like, right. We can let the market decide. It's not like these are, I'm stealing a time slot at 5 p.m. on ESPN from, right. You know, whatever, someone else. It's like, these are infinitely scalable and we'll let the market decide if this is a good product or not. And so I think if anyone wants to start a podcast, I am more than willing to tell my, you know, anything that I know about it, try to be helpful because I think more content is good. And yeah, so I'm excited you're doing this.
Thank you. And I totally agree. I feel like anyone who wants to start writing or doing a podcast or anything should be encouraged. And it's just a jerk move to say there are too many newsletters or too many podcasts or whatever, because you're exactly right. There's no limited shelf
space. It's like, yeah, well, we can let N people decide that. That's the advantage of not having shelf space on the internet, right? And so, yeah.
Exactly. I can scream into the void if I want to.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for doing this and excited to see just how you keep killing it.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. See ya.